warm welcome to our Thursdays with David Foster Wallace series, where we every week read a section of the infamous Infinite Jest with the hope, of course, of finishing the book by the end of the year. Today's section is pages 538 to 574 in the 20th anniversary Back Bay Books edition of the text published by Little Brown and Company. I neglected to mention this a couple weeks ago, but we are actually well past the middle point of the book, putting us ahead in our quest to finish this book by the end of the year. I'm so pleased with our progress, and so just know that it's really amazing for me as the leader of our discussions to see all of our progress as a group through this book. We're starting out here on page 538. This is the middle of a section, and our last section heading was 0450 hours, 11th of November, YDAU, Front Office, Ennett House, DARH, Enfield, Massachusetts. I have two corrections from our last show, and that was, one, the glimpse of the adult weed-addicted person at the beginning of the book, or near the beginning of the book. I believe it's the second full chapter that we really have, the second different narrative after Hal in his college application interview. This person is actually Ken Erdetti. It's not Hal. And so I really thought it was Hal. I outlined all of my evidence to support this in one of the first few episodes, maybe the second or third episode of this series. But I really thought it was Hal even last week when I was talking about it. And no, it's actually Ken, and I would recommend just reading that section over again if you, like me, were convinced that it was Hal or someone else. Also, Roy Tony is a different character from poor Tony Krause, and this is a distinction that is splitting hairs a little bit, but I think it's important to do some character mapping at this point in the book. So poor Tony Krause is who I thought we were talking about last week when we recounted that scene where Ken Erdetti runs into a man who would like to hug him at Narcotics Anonymous, and that ends up being Roy Tony. So Roy Tony we know from near the beginning of the book, certainly within the first third of the book, and that is that beautiful section in this very lush AAVE, African American Vernacular English. It's a hard read, that chapter or that section, but it's well worth it, and so that's where we know him from. We really haven't seen or heard from him or his partners in that thread since, so it's interesting that he's coming up now in the book, so late in the novel. I also think here we have poor Tony Krause. Right, poor Tony Krause is the one that I thought he was again. He's the one with the seizure, and we see him going through this horrible withdrawal, and then at the end of all of it, there's that seizure on the subway. So this episode in many ways is about perspective, and for the most part in this section, we're looking at Randy Lenz. And Randy Lenz, okay. We've seen Randy Lenz before a couple of times, mostly through Gately's perspective as he's looking at the Ennett House residents and really categorizing them in a certain sense. It's a little bit observant, a little bit clinical in that way, the way that Gately looks at all of these residents, this collection of people, and says, oh yeah, Randy Lenz is the guy who blank and reduces each person into really a sentence or two. It's been a really interesting way for us to navigate Ennett House through the eyes of Gately and these very sparse descriptions. So Randy Lenz is a low-level cocaine dealer. He's pretty sleazy. He dresses the part. He wears Ralph Lauren polos and suits. And very squeaky, not squeaky, loud shoes. Shoes that precede him before he walks into a room in terms of the sounds they make when he's walking. And Lenz right now is dealing with a lot of rage and powerlessness. So these are rage and powerlessness, capital R, capital P. And these are two different responses that he's having to not only sobriety, but his very stressful situation where he's hiding from the police because he's a wanted man. So he leaves Ennett House in disguise when he needs to go to NA meetings, and he's in the situation where he's been able to walk back by himself from these meetings that are pretty often. He doesn't always walk back, but when he does, it's by himself, and he takes a long time. And part of that long time, we will discuss later, but part of it is that he likes to take a northwards direction. And we will, again, go over the reasons for the northwards direction a little later, too. So, yeah, again, it's interesting to me that because what we've heard so far with Lens has been pretty scant, it's been not that much information, we have not a very good sense of this character when we are thrust into this whole almost 30 or 40 page section with a lot of focus on him that's very intense focus. It's sort of a false sense of security in some ways because we're going along and along in this very deep narrative focusing on Randy Lens. But we don't know him that well, and I think that we could get caught up maybe in recognizing his narrative voice, for example, but and forgetting at the same time, hey, we actually don't have a lot of exposure to this character. So that's certainly something I would keep in mind if you are still getting to this section or as we move on to further sections in the novel. So we know that Lens is quite strange, and this comes up over and over again in these sections, these little chapters here. So Lens has got a lot of problems, and some recurring themes that we see with him are time and clocks. So part of the reason he does walk in this northward direction is to keep track of this building with a big billboard that says the time on it and a couple other bits of information. He has this thing, again, with maps, with knowing the city, taking convoluted, alley-filled routes, even later on when he gets a partner to walk with, and this theme of powerlessness. And this powerlessness makes him act out in many different ways. In my opinion, it's sort of interesting that Randy Lenz is a childish character. He acts on very childish impulses that take an adult form or an adult body. I have a quote from page 539, quote, Lens abroad in the urban night, solo on almost a nightly basis, sometimes carrying a book, unquote. So it's interesting because this section really starts with an air of mystery. Like, we're not really sure what Lens is up to here. And I'm not sure if that's something that's a limited perspective based on the narrator. What comes later makes me think not. Makes me think that the narrator is playing with us a little bit in terms of style and tone here. But yeah, I love this quote, how mysterious it is and how there's a lot of the first few pages are about Lens searching for something and wanting something to do on his walks, but he doesn't find out exactly what that that compulsion is until later. And this is interesting also because we have Ennett House, who's also suspicious of Lens, right? Ennett House, the people behind it aren't new to this. They're not new to recovering addicts, and they test Lens a lot, actually, with urine and other drug measuring mechanisms, and Lens has come back mysteriously clean through a lot of the testing, and some tests we hear early on have just come back with jumbled results for some reason, and we learn that Lens still is a cocaine addict. He still uses, even despite the very strict rules at Ennett House, and he is busting the strict policy and the tests through ingesting things like pure lemon juice, which messes up his results and, again, these testing results. What's striking here and what really adds on to our theme of perception in the novel is that the narrator mimics Lenz's twisted thought patterns and adopts Lenz's lexicon throughout these passages and these sections. And I think this can contribute, this act of adoption really can contribute to our question of the narrator's identity. And so the narrator is omniscient enough to misuse words in the same way that Lenz does, which I think speaks to a level of intimacy with these characters beyond mere observation. So almost like this narrator has access to these people's thoughts. But also I think that there's just something a little bit beyond what a normal lay character in this book could bring to the narration. And so one of the theories that I'm entertaining right now is that DFW himself is the narrator. I think this is certainly the case in the footnotes at the very least. We know that DFW used footnotes as a huge motivic device in his novels. Brief Interviews with Hideous Men is not an exception to that. Its use of footnotes is quite extensive and quite experimental. But this book, yes, it's known for its footnotes, and I do think that DFW uses it to bring out his own voice within the novel. And you can tell just because the footnotes are totally different, are in a totally different space than any of the narrations, especially when you compare the most likely candidate at this point in the novel for a narrator, which is Dr. Incandenza himself, just because he uses first-person pronouns like I, me, my, yours truly, in sections where it's talking about his childhood and Jim Incandenza is still young. But I really think that this section in particular has something to say about the narrator, and I'm still working through some more thoughts about that, as you all can probably tell, but let me know in the comments what you think. I know a lot of our commenters are predisposed to say that Dr. I is the narrator of Infinite Jest, and I'm keeping my options open. I really am. Of course, it's hard not to be convinced by some of the evidences that you all bring up, but I really am trying to be as observant as possible and as neutral as possible when it comes to this issue, especially since we have a lot of the book left to go. So one example that I did want to bring up just to close out these comments about the narrator is that Joelle Van Dyne, the Veiled One, is referred to as Joelle, as in Joe the first name, L the first letter of the last name, as the tradition in many Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous meetings would prevail for us. And I think that's an interesting misuse of her name or misspelling of her name, just because it speaks to Randy Lenz's inner dialogue and how his mind works a little bit. And the last thing I will say about this for now is that, interestingly, I was thinking about Dr. Incandenza and DFW like Kilgore Trout and Kurt Vonnegut. And as if you guys are longtime listeners of the show, you know that Kurt Vonnegut is an author that's very close to my heart and very special to me. And so just thinking and reflecting on my experiences of reading Kurt Vonnegut's collective works, I really think that Kilgore Trout operates in a very similar way to Dr. Incandenza in this novel. But let me know what you guys think about that. Is that a fair comparison to make? Why or why not? I have a quote on page 541, Ennett House generates serious waste, unquote. This is a quote that really stuck out to me. It's in an odd place in the book, and I had no good place to put this in my spiel today, but I really think that this goes along with our overarching theme in the book of superficiality. And I was wondering in what senses, or sense singular maybe, is this word waste being used? Is waste being used in terms of the actual people at Ennett House, which I think is a likely additive or likely possibility? Or is it just being used in the classical traditional sense of waste? Another reason why this sentence jumped out to me though was because it's so simple and it's a huge point of contrast within these very long, dense paragraphs that we're getting, even from Randy Lenz's perspective. So Randy Lenz eventually in this chapter does start to find out what he is searching for in these alleys late at night, and namely that is killing rats, cats, and dogs in a variety of methods, which are so gruesome that I will refrain from really explaining them on air just because of children perhaps being introduced to this content by way of their parents. So I will just say that it involves trash bags, it involves meatloaves, it involves poison, sometimes lighters, just a myriad of horrible, horrible devices, and pages and pages in this novel are devoted to the methods that Randy Lenz uses to kill these pets, but also these pests. So later on in the book, some of the cats and dogs actually have owners and they're just left outside and he just does off with them in a way similar to these pest alley cats. I would say it's heartbreaking and disturbing, to say the least. And what's interesting to me in that recount this, again, it's pages and pages of this novel devoted to these methods, is that they're so detached. And I think that really plays into this powerlessness theme and this insecurity that Lenz is feeling. And there's a sense that he does know that what he's doing is wrong, but that's not enough. And that's one thing, is he pursues cocaine in an effort to strengthen his sobriety. So he uses it pretty quote-unquote minimally, but the thing is that it's a twisted sense of what sobriety really is, and he's thinking, oh, I'm sacrificing so much and I just need to pick me up, and that's not how sobriety works. And this way of fueling his rage and anger as a result of his powerlessness, that's not how a productive method of solving your issues works. And so yeah, we have this very twisted notion of how the world works, and Randy Lenz, I think in some ways, you know, he knows what's going on is really hard and really awful, and really twisted. He knows that about himself, but he also struggles, I think, with self-control in that regard. So there was a little quip that he thought about murdering a person in the same ways that he treats these animals, and he stopped killing animals for days afterwards because he knew that had crossed a line. And for me, I know that that's a sign that, you know, Lenz is on maybe a quote-unquote better side of this issue, but for me, that's not enough. I'm interested in his path through this novel and how he will end up and whether or not we will have more threads from him, especially later on. And then there's this question of to what extent is Lenz getting away with everything? And that's a question that I'm mulling over more and more these days as I'm thinking about this section, because I'm not sure how much Lenz is getting away with everything. Certainly not with this narrator or with the readers of this novel, not with me at least. With Ennett House, it seems like he's really being able to play them in a lot of ways, especially with the cocaine use. But he starts walking at the end of this little thread with Bruce Green. And Green, we know, has the Mildred Bonk tattoo. We've had little snippets from him throughout the novel at this point. And I'm not sure that he can get past Green with these cocaine uses. And another sort of overarching question for this section that I had was, what limitations are we witnessing in this section in particular of the novel format? And this goes back to what I was talking about earlier with we barely know Lens, yet we have this false sense of familiarity and this false sense of narrative security in some senses. And in what ways is that just a result of this being a novel? And what downfalls do we have in this sort of narration in this novel? And a theme addition for this section before I move on to Early November YDAU is none of the Ennett House doors, save for some of the staff lodgings and some of the offices, are locked. So we can add that to our door repertoire. We had a couple incidences in ComEd last week, and then also the annulation stuff from a couple weeks before. Early November, YDAU, page 548. We have a brief focus here on Rodney Tyne. He's the chief at the OUS and steeply has some connections with the OUS, as we have seen from his conversations with Maraith. Rodney Tyne seems like a pretty stand-up guy. I think the narrator is either neutral about him or likes him pretty okay. But Tyne has this habit of measuring a certain part of his body, again keeping it PG here, every morning since he was 12. And that is his one flaw. That's how it's portrayed in the novel, at least. And yeah, I'm not sure what this actually adds to the novel. I think this is one of those asides or funny quips that we have. And yeah, you can let me know what you think about it in the comments, but we'll not dwell on it too much longer. What we do know in this section, though, is a lot of information. This acts as an informative section, much like Stapley and Maraith's conversation about Infinite Jest, the cartridge. So we know that Infinite Jest has been an at-issue problem for this government organization, and indeed for the country, for a little bit over 2 years. There have been many outbreaks, at least 4, similar to the one that we witnessed firsthand with the medical attaché popping up around the US. So one was in California, of course, one was in Boston. We've had some throughout the Midwest. Johnny Gentle, President Gentle, had to be restrained from viewing the cartridge. He wanted to view the cartridge, interestingly. I think that speaks a lot to his sense of idealism and this character. I think of Gentle as sort of this hollow figure. I think it's not an accident that we've seen him mostly as a puppet in Mario's film. That seems to be the case to me, and in his politics as well. Tyne's team is also responsible for the name The Sum Is Dot. And I'm gonna read for you actually the Oxford English Dictionary definition of sum is dot. So sum is dot, it seems like sum is dot is also another pronunciation. Looking at the IPA here, the frequency is pretty low, but still medium. The word's not obsolete yet. The etymology is from Russian. It is an abbreviation of a self-publishing house, the term for self-publishing house. And the other form that we see of this word is with a capital initial, which interestingly does not appear in Infinite Jest up until this point. I know there's a sum is datur in there, referring to Dr. Incandenza, of course, but that this lowercase version is all I remember seeing in the novel thus far. The definition from the OED again is, quote, the clandestine or illegal copying and distribution of literature originally and chiefly in the USSR, an underground press, a text or texts produced by this, also transferred an attributive or as adjective in samizdat, meaning in this form of publication. And yeah, this has all been enumerated before with Hal, but I wanted to just review that because I do think it will be important for these more informative sections coming up in the novel. And Finally, I'm going to read from page 549 here. There's a quote where they've decoded part of the beginning of Infinite Jest using some methods that are a little bit questionable, to say the least. Again, on page 549, we have a Lance Corporal at Leavenworth was able to report that the thing, Infinite Jest, apparently opens with an engaging and high-quality cinematic shot of a veiled woman going through a large building's revolving doors and catching a glimpse of someone else in the revolving doors, somebody the sight of whom makes her veil billow before the subject's mental and spiritual energies abruptly declined to a point where even near-lethal voltages through the electrodes couldn't divert his attention from the entertainment, capital E, end quote. So here we have really a vision of Joelle, from as far as we know with the information we have, and something about maybe the way that the film is going, the pacing, but we do see this abrupt stop in consciousness when Joelle's veil reveals her face, essentially. So yeah, this film has a lot to do with the technical components of, as we've discussed in previous weeks, but this view, I think, is really informative for our reading of the novel. Next, page 550, we have late PM, Monday the 9th of November, YDAU, going forward in time a little bit and then back in time from the 11th of November section we started with here with Lens. And we have a Pemulus's perspective section here. So from Pemulus's perspective, we have this eavesdropping situation, and it's late at night, and he's listening in on a Stice Rusk appointment. And so Ortho Stice, otherwise known as the Darkness, is talking to the ETA, excuse me, psychologist, and he is expressing some concerns or talking it out. As we know, Rusk's advice is rather ineffectual and convoluted, so I won't get into that too much, but essentially she says Stice has abandonment issues, and Rusk goes into a full discussion of different children's toys and different allegories of children's toys, perhaps, in Ortho Stice's life. Then we go back to the waiting room in ComAd, and this section was really the section that governed our last episode, so I'm surprised to be back here so soon, but not unhappy about it for sure. We know that Pemulus is wearing a ridiculous outfit. It almost sounds to me, someone describes it as a hangover in the novel, a hangover in an outfit. It sounds almost to me like he's dressing up for Halloween with all of the stereotypes of the 80s in tow, something like this. So there's a lot of neons, there's a lot of oranges that don't match in his outfit, etc. And we have this interesting tableau of scenes going on behind these closed yet unlocked doors. So there's CT walking in his stair blaster, and you can hear him sort of breathing and exercising and using his towel. And then Pemulus walks into Avril's office, and Avril and Wayne are role-playing with seems like football attire. I'm not going to get into this too much because of, again, being sensitive to children and our sensitive viewers, but it's a curious scene. If you want to read it, it's in this section starting at 550, and Pemulus interrupts them with no problem. It's all very businesslike and detached. This weird detachment is coming back again in the narrative, which relates to our theme of perspective. But yeah, Pemulus is professional and businesslike. Wayne gets dressed in his sweatpants and sweat clothes and leaves, and Pemulus says, you know, I'll only be a few minutes, and that's where we leave off with this. So interested to see where that narrative goes, if anywhere. Now we have page 553, Wednesday, the 11th of November, YDAU. We're back with Lens, surprise, surprise. So Lenz actually does really like Green as a person and as a partner for his walks, but the problem with that and the problem with Green's accompanying Lenz is that Lenz can't kill animals with Green around for obvious reasons, big red flags. And really Lenz loops consistently in this narrative over and over, obsessively over and over, might I add, about how to tell Green to give Lenz more time alone and to maybe take his own route home every once in a while, but at the same time divulging in some sense that Lenz is fond of Green. And there's this interesting bit about Lenz asking, where do I put my eyes when I tell Green that I like him? And again, self-image plays a huge role in these conversations about where Lenz should put his eyes and what he's going to look like if he does approach Green with this comment. So ironically, he decides to get high at Narcotics Anonymous so he can break it to Green that, hey, I like you, but you should find your own way home on occasion so that I can have some alone time. And it's almost like he explains it almost like he feels that he's more normal with the cocaine than without it. And of course, that's a horribly dangerous sign. And we go through in this chapter a lot of the different symptoms that different patients at Ennett House have when they use cocaine. And Len seems like one of the only staff or one of the only patients that can actually deal with his side effects from it. Which I think does speak interestingly to his behaviors and his compulsions as a drug addict. But interestingly, and again, like with another twist of irony, he never really recalls that he needs to say this all to Green when he is walking home with him, when he gets high, and he has forgotten this in his planning. The coke affects him in a way that he is really saying, I need to tell the people around me every facet of my entire life and existence. And it's interesting because there's a quote that says that Lenz takes a breath of air every couple blocks or so, which I found just so hilarious and so indicative of his state of mind when he is walking home with Green. And yeah, the author's tone still mimics Lenz at this point. For example, instead of recurring dreams, in the text it's written recurving dreams. That's just another Lenzism that we see popping up in the text. And yeah, the narrator, I'm not sure what this exactly says about the narrator yet. Again, that is up to you guys in the comments section to let me know your thoughts and for me to think it over in the next few days or so. But yeah, it's definitely something to note and to keep track of over this section. And yeah, Lenz is all over the place in his conversations with Green. Again, does Green notice is my major question for this thread. And at this point, yes, Lenz is a talkative guy. Yes, he does have a lot of crazy theories about cults and the concavity and all of these different important themes for the novel, but the nature of his thoughts and the nature of his digressions changes quite a bit when he is on drugs versus when he isn't. So there's a narrative interruption at this point, and it's Hal laying in bed and he gets visitors. So first it's Trolch, then it's Pemulus, then it's Wayne. They're just checking in on him. I'm not sure exactly the context just because it's so short and it's so ripped out of the context. It's like in the beginning of the novel when we had a couple lines about the medical attaché still being in the chair at different stages of this viewing process. And yeah, I'm wondering what is the context of this interruption, and I would love to know what you all think about this, but I'm also gonna hang in there and see if this little interruption will get recontextualized later in the novel. So quickly back to Lenz. He talks about a lot of subjects here. As I said before, he's off the rails. He's talking about cults, and he starts talking about the wheelchair assassins. He uses different words that are less nice than the ones I just used. And my question with this is there a thread holding these snippets with Lenz together? Besides, of course, Lenz himself and his immediate insecurities. I think a lot of times these little threads that he brings up are directly tied or directly connected to the insecurities that he is navigating through. I have a quote on page 562. Due north of where yours truly and green strolled through the urban grids, end quote. So yours truly is used again. This is a word that was used earlier in the novel, and I'm wondering who is yours truly. Seems like the narrator, seems like Lenz, but I have no idea. And the last bit is that there's sort of a concavity update in this crazy drug-induced narrative. It's very fragmented here, and that update is that pets and pests and aborted infants have taken over the concavity area that has been cordoned off and is no longer part of the U.S., and these organisms have taken over residential homes and have created, it seems like, in some senses, their own society within this wasteland that the U.S. has given up. And of course, the question here comes up with the unreliable narrator in some sense. I don't think that Lenz's perspective, as we've seen with even these words and these little quips that he talks about, it's not always reliable. And I think that's something that we do have to consider as we are moving on and learning about some things from Lenz's perspective. All right, on page 563, we have the title here is really long. It's selected snippets from the individual, resident, informal interface moments of D.W. Gately, live-in, staff, Ennett House Drug and Alcohol Recovery House, Enfield, Massachusetts, on and off from just after the Brookline Young People's AA meeting up to about 23-29 hours, Wednesday, 11th of November, YDAU. So we're back sort of in some ways where we started with this episode today. Again, another play on perspective here. It's really obvious from the outset of this chapter or this thread that we have a conversation between Joelle and Dawn. The conversation from last week that we looked at really confused me at first. I was like, who is in this conversation and why? But yeah, it's their discourse is now very recognizable within the discourse of the novel. And it starts out with this comment, this line about football, and I think that this theme of unresolved tension between Orin and Joelle has come up a couple times and will continue to come up within this section. We have a couple of bits with Orin coming up here, but yeah, I think this football comment and their conversation thread about football that we enter in on does cue us into this maybe weird dynamic between Joelle and Orin still, and I hope we find out more about that as we go along in the novel. And yeah, the rest of this section is super amazing. It's fragmented in a similar way to Green's section just before, in that there's all of these crazy conversations, these crazy comments from the Ennett House patients, where Gately is just the recipient of all of these crazy scenarios. So there's one where a woman named Yolanda comes up to Gately and is talking essentially about Randy Lenz's inappropriate use of being Yolanda's sponsor and his comments to her that are less than kosher to make here. Foss also comes up to Gately and says, look, there are these people, these patients that are really not being great influences on the new charges at Ennett House. and maybe they can come talk to you. And then there's some toilet issues, of course, seems to always occur when we have Gately in the room. And it's just an interesting tableau of all of these different, again, perspectives coming along in the text. We have this ginormous footnote 234, where it's transcripts from Helen Steepley's article about Orin and about the mad stork. And it's interesting because Orin is hitting on Steepley throughout the entire interview. I thought it was hilarious just the ways in which he would bring it up. He would say something like, ah, only a certain type of gal could wear a pantsuit, and things of this nature. Just really hilarious the way that DFW integrates these offhand comments from Orin within the text. There's a story about Marlon Bane, and Marlon Bane has come up before in the novel, but essentially he's this student, Orin's age at ETA, and he's no longer there, of course, but he was at ETA when Orin was there, and he has a sweating problem, but he also has OCD. And so the reason why Orin is talking about Marlon Bane is because Marlon Bane and the moms have this sort of connection through OCD, and the moms definitely has OCD. There's a note that she's compulsive about her compulsions, which is, of course, very extreme. She moderates her compulsions even so that she can still be efficient throughout the day. And Orin, his mediation of information during this interview is really interesting because he's simultaneously giving out a ton of information to Helen Steepley during the interview, but he's also protecting, in some ways, information because of the impact it might have on his brothers. So he knows that his brothers will read whatever profile Helen Steepley publishes, or it's likely that they will, and he omits answers and refuses to answer some questions because of that perceived effect that he might have on his brothers, which I find really strange, the way that he decides at some points I'm gonna just tell it all, and at some points he really, really is resistant. So important, I think maybe the most important thing about this section is that in the footnotes, the mold story is told for the second time directly from Orin. So the first time at the beginning of the novel, this mold story was told from Hal's perspective, but it was Hal recounting Orin's recount of the story. So it was through these two different positions, and it was sort of obscured, I think, as a result. And really important is this image that we didn't get the full picture of the first time of the moms when she finds Orin with the mold. She's screaming, "My son ate this, my son ate this," over and over, and everyone is crying. Hal and Orin and the moms are crying, and simultaneously here we have himself and Mario squeezed up against the glass of the house, looking out into the garden, and it's almost a still life, this picture, as I imagined it in the book. And there's just this massive amount of gridlock and inaction when there should have been immediate action and immediate reaction, almost, to this very important and very stressful and scary event where Hal ate some mold that he found when he was still a toddler. There's also an incident going back to the real time frame of this section with Orin and this Swiss hand model at Sky Harbor Airport. Orin is driving Steepley to Sky Harbor just to spend time with him, essentially, and to no avail. He does not move forward in their relationship, obviously, but there's this question and this recurring tension with Orin with these sexual feelings and encounters and expectations that are in some respects resultant from his time with Joelle. And again, we get this unresolved conflict with Joelle and how he really had something in the novel, it says something real, something really substantial with her, and how he'll never recover after losing that very substantial relationship where he was monogamous for that time. And he actually has compulsions as well. He is very critical of the moms and her compulsions and her way of doing things, but he has compulsions in the form of cosmic signs. So he'll say a dead bird in the pool, as we mentioned a couple weeks ago, is a bad cosmic sign, and the encounter with the Swiss hand model in some respects was a good cosmic sign because of her behaviors during their encounter. And that is that for that section. And the last thread, we are wrapping up a very long episode today. Some people like long episodes, some people don't. You can let me know what your thoughts are on these in the comments. I'm sure everyone has something to say about them. We have Idris Arsianian. I think I'm pronouncing this incorrectly. Trying my best here. He's a 13-year-old from Pakistan, and he has a blindfold on, and he's standing outside the hallway that leads to the weight room. And so there's more information, curiously, about this blind student that is on his way to ETA that Hal is supposed to watch over. There's more info about that in last week's episode. And Idris encounters first Ted Schacht, and it's really funny during this actual section here. He has to go to the bathroom really, really badly, and he refuses to take the blindfold off because there's a Siri that you can use, sort of echolocation and how hard the ball hits the racket to predict where the ball is going on the court when you play tennis, so it makes you a better, faster, more predictive tennis player in some respects. So he's trying to hone his skills with his ears, his auditory skills, yet he is really struggling and he needs to be led to the bathroom. And across the hall in the weight room, Dushut may flunk out of ETA, and he is dealing with some really intense issues with his self-esteem and his academic career, and he's thinking to himself, oh, I'm wasted at 15, and obviously this is not the case. So Lyle and Mario are in the weight room helping them, or helping Dushut out, and he's the one with the mole. We've encountered him before. He sort of reminds me of Lamont Chu in terms of the theme and the scope of his issues, and he has issues with his mole. Again, looking back at this outside theme of image, and so many characters at this point really contribute to that, including now Lens, Dushut, Joelle, to a certain extent, Avril and CT and Hal and ETA as a whole. We can look at institutions here, and at House maybe as a whole, not so much as ETA for sure. Don Gately has some stock in this as well, as he's trying to appear really outstanding. He's trying to do the prayers even though he doesn't believe in them, and he really needs a clean record so he's not pushed off to jail tomorrow. So yeah, this Dushut character is just another small instance of this theme that we are experiencing throughout the novel on many scales, large and small. Schacht leaves, and then Pemulis comes, and he's just joking around at first, then he starts talking about annulation. I'm not going to go into that too much just because it's really scientific and complicated, and I'm not the authority on annulation here. And then he goes into Dr. Incandenza's late contributions to the field of annulation and physics more generally, and there's some sustainability awards and things that he got, and it's interesting because he was essentially a full-blown alcoholic for the last, he was what most people would call blackout level, kind of less than efficient in his life, so to speak. For those last 3 years, yet he made these amazing contributions and these amazing pushes forward. So he had these horrible tremors and things from the alcohol and all these problems, yet he was contributing in his fields, he was still inventing, and he was making films on the side, and his relationship with Joelle is also quite developing and quite tense at this point. So this over-formalized dialect, this is one of the last two comments that I'm making in this episode today. The over-formalized dialect that we get from Idris here is another example of this imperfect recounting. this imperfect voice of the narrator that I think is really interesting linguistically to look at, because this is not an exact transcription of what this kid is saying. I'm very, very certain of that, because even a kid who is an ESL speaker from Pakistan, he won't have this kind of diction. And I think that the narrator is hearing things and then putting it through his lens, or this person's lens, whoever he or she is, and then writing it down, then transcribing it from their memory. So this is something that I think we could and should look forward to and keep looking out for in the novel in the future. And the final comment that I'll make is a plot comment, which we know that Pemulus is sort of devious in some ways, because he has this whole drug organization going on at UTA, and he also collects urine from younger kids in order to help the older kids pass their urine exams while still being able to take their drugs of any kind. And as we know, Idris really needs to go to the bathroom, so Pemulus sort of does a trade-off sort of scenario at the end where he says, yes, I'll take you to the bathroom, but I have a proposal to discuss with you while we are there. So that is all I have for today. As always, questions and comments can be accessed via the link in the description. You can either comment on our blog, on Twitter, or on our Relevance of Literature comment page, which is directly linked again in the description down below. I always really appreciate you guys' feedback and your comments, so if you have a couple minutes, I would again really appreciate it. Have a good weekend, you guys, and I will talk to you again on Monday. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the Ongoing Series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.